Theater of Pain cost less than $200,000 to make. Dr. Feelgood was $600,000, and both times we got our money's worth. After a few months, the Karabi album already cost as much as every prior Motley record combined. But no one could talk to these guys anymore. Even Chuck Shapiro was afraid of them. So I called a band meeting in Vancouver and passed around some spreadsheets that Chuck had prepared. "You guys have been working on this album for 5 months, and it's over $1 million so far," I told them. "Here's where the $1 million went, and that doesn't even count the bills coming in from the last 5 weeks." Nikki took the spreadsheets and threw them at me. "You're just negative," he raged. "You're killing all my creativity by telling me this kind of shit." And he stormed out of the room, meeting over. 14 months and $2 million later, the record was finally finished. The week it came out, it entered the pop charts at number 7. I wiped the sweat off my forehead, thinking that maybe everything was worth it after all, and the new band actually did have a shot. The next week, a friend who gets the chart numbers early called me. "You're not going to believe this," he said. "Your album dropped from number 7 all the way to 28. And that's when the freakout began.
Chapter 11, in which our heroes waive the opportunity for any promotional assistance at a critical juncture in their adventure by initiating an unwinnable duel with that droll beast, MTV. Tabitha Soren, MTV News host. "Hitting the road in June, we hear, will be Motley Crue, who recently returned to the scene with a new, self-titled album, their first in 4 years, and their first with John Corabi, who's replaced original vocalist Vince Neil. We spoke with the Crue recently about the new album, the new sound, and the new guy. When we brought up the old days, however, things got ugly. Take a look." Voiceover. "Motley Crue is back, and with a new album and lead singer, they say they're bigger and better than ever. But in a time when metal groups are having trouble staying in the top 10, do the fans even care? It was only a few short years ago that the group was fronted by Vince Neil. The new one is the first with former The Scream lead John Corabi." Tommy. "It's a pretty natural evolution. When John came in to audition, we were looking for a singer. He came in and strapped on a guitar. We were like, whoa, what's going on? And we started jamming, and he was like, hey, check out this riff. It was just real natural for us to jump on the riff as a band and all jam together, and all of a sudden the sound got twice as fat. And all these things just naturally started coming, so it just kind of really flowed and happened and did its thing." Voiceover. "And with Corabi now in place, we thought we'd get the deal on the much-publicized falling out with Neil." Interviewer. "What happened with Vince?" Nikki. We'll save that for the book." Tommy laughs. Nikki. "We don't want to talk about that. No one cares anyway." Voiceover. "Okay, but do they care when their former bandmate sustained several broken ribs and internal injuries while jet skiing a few weeks ago?" Nikki laughs. Nick. "My heart goes out to you. Hey, what happened to the coral reef then?" Nikki. "Oh, man. Hey, when 300 pounds of blubber landed on the coral reef, you know there was some dust flying around." Mick, singing Girls Just Wanna Have Lunch. "How come they don't weigh a ton?" Nikki. "Okay, here we go. Now you know that's going to be run." Voiceover. "At least the group showed they still had a sense of humor when asked about women, fire, and hairspray, the main components of their videos in years past." Nikki. "Dude, that is a bleep stupid question." Tommy. "Dr. Feelgood wasn't like that. Same old wasn't like that." Nikki. "You know what? Let's knock the interview off. This is bleep getting really stupid. Women, hairspray, and fire?" Removes microphone clip from jacket lapel and rises to leave. On-air collage shows scenes from Motley Crue videos. Women at strip club from the Girls, Girls, Girls video, hairspray spritzed at the camera from the Home Sweet Home video, and fire exploding around Tommy Lee's drum set from the Wild Side video. In the background, there is an audio loop of Nikki complaining women, hairspray, and fire, synchronized with the corresponding images on the screen. Nikki. "Dude, who wrote those questions?" Rest of band walks out of interview.
Chapter 12. Nikki. How our motley fools discover that the bitter fruit of failure is indeed a poison apple. We made a great record with John Corabi, and we were sure it was going to sell millions of copies and blow up bigger than Dr. Feelgood. We were going to tour without pyrotechnics and dancing chicks and spinning drum cages and still kick the audience's ass. We were going to show them that without a frontman dancing in the spotlight, we could play heavy four-piece rock and roll like never before. And we were going to challenge them with lyrics and images about fascism and stereotyping that would blow their minds. We were going to do whatever we wanted because, after all, we were Motley Crue. Or were we? It only took one concert, the first stop on our tour, for all those hopes and expectations to crash and burn at my feet. The show was in Tucson, Arizona, and only 4,000 tickets had been sold for a 15,000-seat amphitheater. I went on the radio before the concert and said to the fans, "Listen, it's the first night of the tour, so I'm doing something special. Meet me outside the radio station after the show, and I'll put each and every one of you on the guest list." If I had said that in 1989, there would have been 10,000 teenagers rioting in the parking lot. That afternoon, two Mexican kids showed up, and that's when I realized it was all over. It had been 4.5 years since Dr. Feelgood came out. We had a new lead singer, and alternative rock had not only come in the meantime, it had gone as well. The world wasn't holding its breath for a new Motley Crue album. To make matters worse, our entire record label abandoned us because Krasnow and most of the top Elektra and Warner Brothers executives were fleeing their jobs as a massive battle was being waged in the corporate boardrooms. Plus, true to our nature, we had just alienated the only people who could still save the album, MTV. They conveniently edited out the part of the interview where I threatened to knock the host's teeth out if he asked us about women, hairspray, and fire one more time. At our next gig, 1,600 people showed up. Then it was 800. Soon we were sending trucks home and scaling back arena shows to theaters and theaters to clubs. Last time out, we were flying in jets and playing sold-out arenas. Now we had to change in our bus at some shows because there was no dressing room backstage, creep through the bus aisle with our instruments, and walk onto a tiny stage illuminated by flashing beer lights to play for 50 kids. Every now and then, though, we'd be surprised. In Mexico City, 20,000 people packed the arena, and we played a set that made it all seem worthwhile. Afterward, Chuck Shapiro called and told us the tour was going under. What? I refused to accept defeat. There were 20,000 people here tonight screaming their heads off. Are you crazy? The next day, we had a band meeting. I wrote a check for $75,000 to keep the band on the road. Tommy wrote a check for $75,000. Karabi forfeited his salary of $10,000 a week for the remainder of the tour. And as for Mick, he couldn't contribute a thing because Emmy had taken all his money. He couldn't say we didn't warn him about shitting in his own backyard. But our efforts were futile. Mexico City was a fluke, and it only took a few more depressing club shows before we had to cancel the tour and come home making all kinds of excuses to rationalize what had happened to us. For 10 years solid, we had been invincible. No one could touch us. Tommy and I had raped a drunk girl in the closet, and she had forgotten about it. Vince had killed someone in a car accident and gotten away with it. We had released two albums we hardly even remembered recording, and they still sold like crazy. I had overdosed and forced the cancellation of our European tour, and our popularity only increased. Our egos were out of hand. Tommy and I thought, to hell with Vince Neil. He doesn't write a single song, he drinks a lot, and he can be a pain in the ass. We thought it was all about us, Nikki and Tommy, the Terror Twins. We forgot that we were a team, and Vince was the quarterback. We forgot what made us Motley Crue, the chance collision of four very driven, very flawed, and very different personalities.
Part 10. Without You. Chapter 1. Vince. Vince looks back on a youth comparable to the great dramas of the previous century, most notably Boys in the Hood and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. While I was on my own, I tried to avoid two things. One was listening to any John Corabi songs, which wasn't difficult since they were never on the radio anyway. The other was my own press clippings. I was so tired of the band saying that I was selfish, that I walked around with the attitude that the world owed me something, that I was a pampered pretty boy who had inflicted suffering on everyone and never had to suffer a day in his life. Nicky was cool because he was a street kid. Mick was cool because he had spent so long in so many bands. But nobody knew a thing about me. Nobody cared where I came from. And I came from the worst place you can imagine. Compton. My father, Odie, was a half-Indian auto mechanic and full-time ladies' man from Paris, Texas, who worked for the L.A. County Mechanical Division repairing sheriff's cars. My mother, Shirley, was a half-Mexican lady from New Mexico, who worked for Max Factor at a factory. Between them, they had so little money that every year they moved me to a worse neighborhood, from Inglewood to Watts to Compton, where they put my younger sister Valerie and me into kindergarten. In elementary school, Valerie and I first realized we were different from everybody else. We were the only white kids in our whole school and neighborhood. Several dozen Crips used an apartment across the street from us as a clubhouse, and at the end of the block, there was a house where another gang, the A.C. Deuces, hung out. The Crips and the A.C. Deuces were always warring and shooting at each other, and whenever we left the house, my mother would cross herself and pray that none of us met with a stray bullet. Every day, the neighborhood seemed to deteriorate more. But my parents refused to move, even when a bullet came hurtling through my sister's window in the middle of the night. One day, I was walking home from school, and four kids ran up to a well-dressed teenager, shot him, took his sneakers, and left him lying in the street. He couldn't even speak. There was so much blood gurgling out of his mouth. A few days later, I was waiting for the ice cream man in front of my house when I saw the same four kids across the street hanging out near the Crips house. I looked down at my sneakers and figured that they wouldn't fit those guys, so I was safe. They looked at me and began to cross the street exactly to where I was standing. I prayed that they wanted ice cream, too. A tall guy walking on the left side of the group with a black t-shirt and raised red scars running up his arms kept staring at me the whole time. My throat went dry, and sweat prickled down the sides of my body, rooting me to the ground. He separated from his friends, walked up to me, and smiled. Then he grabbed me, wheeled me around so that he was standing behind me, stuck his hands in my pockets, and grabbed my ice cream money. It happened so quickly that I couldn't feel a thing when a blade sliced across my skin from ear to ear. I thought that he had slit my throat, and when he released me and ran away, I collapsed to the ground. I was sure I was dead. No one in the neighborhood even lifted a finger to help me. They just stared at me like I was a trash bag left out for the garbage truck to collect. I stood up and put my hand to my neck. I was covered in blood. But the guy had missed my jugular and only cut the side of my face and chin. All that for 15 cents. And at the hospital, I got free ice cream anyway. When I returned to class the next day, my teacher, Mrs. Anderson, lavished so much attention on me that it was almost worth it. Even before puberty, I had a nose for playmates. And not only did Mrs. Anderson used to be one, but she still looked like one. She had long, iron straight brown hair and a figure that made me feel like I was in the Warner Brothers cartoon with the big city showgirl and the country bumpkin wolf whose tongue rolls down his mouth and across the floor when he sees her. Thanks to Mrs. Anderson, I had a revelation that was to be the guiding principle of my life. Chicks are hot. I didn't know what tits were or what sexy was, but somewhere deep inside, I knew that whatever those words meant, their definition was Mrs. Anderson. I took advantage of every opportunity I could to get close to her. I still own a Playmate book with her photo in it. In her class, if you behaved well and folded your hands properly on your desk and read aloud with proper diction, Mrs. Anderson gave you the honor of walking in the front of the line to lunch and recess. And as she led the line, Mrs. Anderson would hold your hand. That day in school, I got to hold Mrs. Anderson's hand again. Little did she suspect what I was thinking. On parents' night, I was so confused I introduced her to everyone as my mother. I wanted to be her lover or her son. I didn't care which. She opened up something inside of me that never closed. Thanks to her, I found myself the following year at age 10, under the doghouse with a girl named Tina, sticking my hands up her skirt and just feeling what was there. I didn't know what sex was, so I thought that was what I was supposed to do with girls. As young as we were, however, we were far from innocent. The kids in my class were joining gangs. Some of them even carried knives in their lunchboxes, and several kids in sixth grade already had guns. I quickly learned a cardinal rule of survival. Make friends with people bigger than yourself. One such giant was Andrew Jones, a classmate whose brother was a Crip leader, thus protecting me from any more harassment from the Crips across the street. Once I was accepted by the cool kids, I pretty much became a delinquent like them. I throw rocks at cars and set fires to garbage cans in school. Some of the kids had BB guns and we'd meet in a deserted lot and play army. I would return home almost every day bleeding from my head, chest, or arms because of BB gun wounds. Eventually, as the neighborhood continued to decline, the empty lots turned into cheap warehouses. One day after school, three black kids, one Samoan, and I snuck over a barbed wire fence and passed two security guards to break into a warehouse that was full of seaside souvenirs. Giant conch shells, sponges, and coral necklaces. We took whatever fit in our backpacks and sold it on a street corner. If I had grown up in a normal neighborhood, maybe I would have had a lemonade stand instead of one selling hot merchandise. At the Compton swap meet, I used the money I made to buy my first cassette, Cloud Nine by The Temptations. Soon I was obsessed with soul, Al Green, The Spinners, The Temptations, The Four Tops. That was ghetto music back then. With my extra money, and with $5 of allowance earned cleaning the Ford and washing windows for my dad each week, I began buying Matchbox cars and singles like Smoke on the Water, Dream On, Hooked on a Feeling, The Night Chicago Died, and a personal favorite, Clap for the Wolfman. But my riches came to an end when the police caught me running out of a warehouse with a box of stolen gardening supplies, handcuffed me, and brought me back to my parents. When I came home from school the following day with a story about how some kids had thrown a teacher out of a window, my parents had finally heard and seen enough. With both of them working, they couldn't have two unsupervised kids running around Compton stealing flower bulbs and watching their teachers fly out of windows. They moved my sister and me to my aunt's house in Glendora until they could sell the house in Compton. Eventually, my mom landed a better-paying job at a dental brace factory and found a place in Glendora where I transferred into Sunflower Junior High. Except for Mrs. Anderson's class, I had always been a terrible student, and classes at Sunflower were a struggle compared to Compton. I found it nearly impossible to write even a simple sentence until I learned that I had a form of dyslexia. Rather than working on my problem, I chose to skip school, learn how to surf, and make money the way I had in Compton. Walking to school one day, I found a paperback full of hardcore sex photos. When I told the other kids about it, they all wanted to see it. But the book wasn't theirs, it was mine. And if they wanted to see it so badly, they'd have to pay for it. I hid the book in a pile of junk in my next-door neighbor's garden shed, and every day I'd rip out 10 pages, bring them to school, and sell them for a quarter each. After about 70 pages, our gym coach busted me when some kids taping photos on the walls of the boys' locker room told him where they'd gotten the porn. When I was suspended, I decided I'd just get rid of the whole book for $5. So I went to my neighbor's shed, opened the door, and it was gone. I still don't know who took it. It was probably Tommy Lee. When I was 15, though I didn't even have a driver's license, my father gave me his 54 Chevy pickup truck so that I could take myself to junior high. With motion came freedom, and I discovered drugs, alcohol, and fucking. I'd go to the beach, surf all morning, drink screwdrivers, and then pass out on the beach. I always fell asleep with my hand over my stomach, so that I spent most of my teenage years sunburned head to toe, except for a white hand-shaped tattoo on my belly. My surfing buddy John turned me on to my first drug, angel dust. When I tried it, I was crammed with four friends in a 65 Nova at a drive-in theater screening Silver Streak. John laced some pot with angel dust and handed the pipe to me. I didn't know how much I was supposed to smoke, and I wanted to keep up with John, so I ended up getting so stoned that I could hardly even move or speak. I couldn't wait to come down. A security guard came knocking on the window, and I was sure he was going to take us to jail, especially when John rolled down the glass and smoke came billowing out. "Sir," the guard said, "please remove your foot from the brake. Your taillights are bothering the people in the cars behind you." "Oh, I didn't realize," John said, and took his foot off the pedal. I walked out of the car to go to the snack bar, which was in the back of the parking lot. Though the pavement only sloped slightly upward, It felt like I was climbing a mountain. I began to sweat and run out of breath as I struggled to put one foot in front of the other. It took forever because I kept stopping to lean against cars and rest. Going downhill on the way back, the ground seemed so steep I could hardly walk. I fell about 8 times and skinned my knees and arms trying to navigate my way down this Mount Everest, which, if I wasn't high, would have seemed almost completely level. Before I was even halfway to the car, I'd spilled all the popcorn and soda I was carrying. Of course, I was so stoned that I kept clutching the empty cups and cartons as if they were still full while I tripped and stumbled toward the car. Soon, John had me getting baked in school. In English class, I sat there so lost in space that whenever the teacher talked to me, I sat at my desk motionless, showing no sign of having heard her. When she sent me to the principal's office, I never made it there. 2 hours later, the principal found me wandering around the football field. I had no idea where I was. Next, John turned me on to White Cross, or Cross Tops, a little white upper with an X mark on the top, which, when combined with angel dust, turned me into a frothing madman. Amped up on speed and dust in the parking lot before shop class one afternoon, I noticed that my surfboard racks were missing from the top of my truck. I obsessively searched everywhere until I found them in the car of a football player named Horace. I ran into the school, found him at his locker, and confronted him. He was a steel-chested, bowl-cutted jock who constantly filed his nails and teeth into claws and fangs to terrorize underclassmen. After denying he had seen my racks for 5 minutes, he walked up to me, thrust his chest in my face, and looked down. "Well, what are you going to do about it?" he barked, puffing his animal breath on the top of my head. Without even hesitating or stopping to think, I clenched my fist and hit him in the face. It connected so hard that I heard a cracking sound. He hit the ground like an ape shot out of a tree, cracking his head on the floor. His eyes rolled back in their sockets and he was gone. It shocked the fuck out of me that I had laid him out like that, with a broken nose and cheekbone, it turned out. I walked into shop class, buzzing and nursing my bleeding knuckles, but otherwise acting as if nothing had happened. 10 minutes later, the principal walked in, looked at my knuckles, brought me into his office, and had me arrested for assault. My mom picked me up at the police department, and though no charges were pressed, I was suspended for 4 days. When I returned to school, nobody fucked with me again, and all the other football players who hated Horace anyway treated me like a hero. Near school in the San Gabriel Valley, there was a roller skating rink called Roller City, where John and I would try to pick up girls. That was where I realized that I liked being on stage. Every day they had a lip-syncing contest, so me, John, and another surfing buddy signed up. We dressed in flared pants, loud open-button polyester shirts, wigs, and other accessories we thought rock stars were supposed to wear. The song of the day was Bachman Turner Overdrive's Let It Ride. So I jumped around on stage, goofed off, played air guitar, and threw the microphone around. The crowd ate it up, and not only did we win, but I got laid that night. Soon, me and my friends were on a lip-syncing circuit, driving to roller rinks in Cucamonga and malls and Diamond Bar to compete. The next time I won was 2 weeks later, when I dressed like some combination of Ray and Dave Davies of the Kings for You Really Got Me. But the difference between this contest and the other ones was that I was really singing. And I sounded good. I never knew I had it in me. Now that I had a car, long hair, and was sort of a singer, girls were everywhere. Since my trusting parents were at work all day, I'd take girls home and fuck them during lunch. I dated a stoner named Jody for a while and a girl whose real name was actually Candy Hooker. Her father had invented hooker headers for racing cars. For high school, I thought I was doing pretty well for myself. Maybe too well. During one lunch break, I went to the parking lot with a girl named Tammy, who had started lavishing attention on me after I broke my leg at a skate park in Glendora. I banged her in front of my truck with the noonday sun shining on my ass. That was all. I didn't think about her again until 2 months later. She pulled me aside after school, and I naturally assumed she wanted some more. But instead, she told me that she was pregnant and that she really wanted to keep the baby. I didn't really love her or want a girlfriend, but when I realized that she was going through with it, I tried to make it work. I spent a lot of time with her and supported her when she was kicked out of school because they didn't allow pregnant girls in class. We eventually ended up at the same continuation school. When I was 16, she gave birth to a boy, Neil. I was working on a sound crew loading equipment for a Runaways concert when my mom screeched into the parking lot and told me that my son had been born. Despite having spent the last 7 months with Tammy, the reality didn't sink in until I saw this cute, teeny, bald, slobbering thing that my sperm had given life to. I looked at him, fell in love, and then went into shock. I didn't know what I was supposed to do with him. Fortunately, Tammy's parents and mine helped raise him, and I became the only kid in Charter Oak High School paying child support. That year, a guy named James Alverson transferred into my school. He was a guitar player, and it seemed like he wasn't at school to learn, but to form a band. The moment he stepped through the doors, he started eyeing and sizing up every eligible guy like a talent scout. He finally settled on me. I didn't even have to sing for him. He liked me because I had the longest hair in school. He found a bassist named Joe Marks and a drummer named Robert Stokes, both surfer dudes with long sideburns. From our first rehearsal, it felt good. James was a great guitar player, had long blonde hair like mine, modeled his playing after Eddie Van Halen's, and had a quirky, animated Rick Nielsen stage presence. When I started singing, I complimented him perfectly because I sounded like Robin Zander with his balls being pinched. James named us Rock Candy and put us to work, learning I Want You to Want Me by Cheap Trick, Sweet Emotion by Aerosmith, and Smoking in the Boys' Room by Brownsville Station for our first concert at a local prom. We soon developed a great scam for getting cash. We'd pick some idiot in school who didn't have any friends, find out when his parents were going out of town, and give him the sales pitch, which went something like this. Hey, look, we know you want to be popular in school. Here's an easy way to do it. When your parents leave, have a party at your house. We'll play for free and make sure tons of chicks come. All you have to do is be home and maybe buy some alcohol if you can, and you've got a free band and your pick of any girl you want to take to your parents' bedroom. What do you think? They always said yes. Then we'd spread the word at school, charge each person a dollar to get in, and after 300 or 400 people showed up, call the cops and ourselves and take off with about $100 each. Between Rock Candy, surfing, Tammy, Neil, Crosstops, and Angel Dust, I didn't have much time left over for classes, and soon got kicked out. I worked sweeping up at a recording studio in exchange for rehearsal time for Rock Candy. But when I realized that I was on a fast track to nowhere, I decided to listen to my parents and try to finish school. Adopting the studio's address as my own, so that my parents wouldn't see my report cards and disciplinary notices, I enrolled in Royal Oak High in Covina, where I drank beer in the morning and then ditched the afternoon classes to jam with Tommy Lee, a scrawny, excitable kid who played with another band on the backyard party circuit, US 101. Though everybody knew me in the school because of Rock Candy, Tommy was the only guy I really liked or bothered with. I fought with pretty much everybody else. When my parents left town for a weekend, I booked a Rock Candy concert at my own house and made the band promise not to call the police this time. Nearly 400 kids showed up, but instead of cops, my parents returned unexpectedly in the middle of the insanity. Strangely, they didn't get pissed. They watched me sing, and afterward, my dad picked up on high school chicks with my mom served drinks. After the party, they never said a word to me about it. Perhaps my parents had seen so much in Compton, they were just glad I was alive and enjoying life. That, or they knew that if they tried to discipline me, I'd leave home and sleep at the studio or at Tommy's. Whatever their reason, they let me get away with anything, even eventually dropping out of school. My parents couldn't stop me, my principal couldn't stop me, and Horace, the biggest high school football player around, couldn't stop me. That's probably what gave me a feeling of invulnerability that my experience in Motley Crue did nothing to dispel. Without that, I probably never would have had the confidence to lead a ragged, punch-drunk band like Motley Crue when the opportunity came. The first thing I did when Motley Crue became famous was climb into a white stretch limo and ask the chauffeur to drive me to my old schoolyard, where I flipped off all the teachers and yelled, "Fuck you, assholes," out of the window as loudly as I could. In my mind, they had failed me. I didn't need them at all. I did not think that I'd ever get taught a lesson, because I had no use for lessons. I didn't read, I didn't write, I didn't think. I just lived. Whatever happened in the past happened. Whatever's going to happen in the future is going to happen anyway. Whatever is happening in the present moment was always what I was interested in. So when my moment of reckoning came, I'd already committed 34 years of my life to invincibility. Not only did I not expect it, but I couldn't even conceive of the possibility. Fate, however, has a way of finding your vulnerabilities where you least expect them, illuminating them so that you realize how glaringly obvious they are, and then mercilessly driving a spike straight into their most delicate center.
Chapter 2. Tommy. Of what passed between Tommy and Vince, and of how it led to second thoughts on the propriety of discharging fluids on an effigy of said singer. Our attitude was, fuck Vince, dude. He was lazy, he didn't care, he didn't contribute to Motley Crue, and he had no fucking respect for any of us. He became a punching bag, united against motherfucking Vince. We even put a picture of him on the back of the toilet, dude, so that when we went to the bathroom, we could piss on his face. But the bottom line was that Vince never put us down when he left the band. We put Vince down. So, which of us was the asshole? I didn't talk to Vince for 3 years, 6 months and 6 days after he left, until I heard that his daughter Skylar had slipped into a coma and died. That night I called him at home. His voice wasn't even recognizable as the Vince I knew. He sobbed, babbled, and hurled abuse at himself for an hour or more over the phone. It was all bad. That's against the laws, man, he kept screaming, bashing the phone against something. It's against the rules of the universe. I couldn't understand a single thing in his crazy talk other than the fact that the guy was in extreme pain and had probably crawled inside a bottle to hide. I don't know how he ever made it through that and managed to become a human being again. I don't think he even remembers me calling.
Chapter 3. Vince. Concerning matters which cannot be reduced to a pithy, italicized phrase of antiquarian explication. At first, Charisse thought it was the flu. Skylar was complaining of stomach pains, headaches, and nausea, so Charisse put her to bed. That night, Skylar's symptoms worsened. Her stomach started hurting so badly that she doubled over, clutching it. When Charisse tried to take her to the bathroom, she discovered that Skylar was hurting too much to even walk. She wiped the dirty blonde hair out of Skylar's face, dabbed at the tears with the Kleenex, and drove her to the hospital. That was when she called me at the Long Beach Grand Prix after party. I drove to the West Hills Medical Center with more speed and adrenaline than I had used in the race, and joined Charisse, who was crying on her mother's shoulder in the hospital emergency room. The last hour had been a nightmare, they said. The doctors had assumed that Skylar's appendix had exploded, but when they anesthetized her and began the procedure for an appendectomy, they found her appendix healthy and intact. Instead, they saw that a cancerous tumor around her abdomen had exploded, spreading cancer all through her body. The tumor, they said, was the size of a softball. I couldn't understand how such a large tumor had appeared in Skylar. I always associated cancer and tumors with old people, not my 4-year-old. After another hour, they let Charisse and me into the intensive care unit to see Skylar. When I saw her attached to all these tubes and machines, for once in my life, I didn't know what to do. This was my daughter, hooked up to a life support system. When I had seen her just a weekend ago, she'd been running circles around my legs trying to make me dizzy. Charisse and I sat side by side without a word for the first time in 2 years, waiting for Skylar to stir. After an hour, she rolled around, mumbled something about Cinderella, and fell back asleep. Charisse and I looked at each other and wanted to cry with relief. The next day, Skylar was almost fully conscious and lucid. And she was as scared as I had been the night before when I saw the tubes and machines. She asked where she was and why she was there and what all this stuff was. We explained as gently as we could that she had something growing in her stomach, like a flower, but it wasn't supposed to be there, so the doctors took it out. She smiled weakly and said she wanted to go home. I asked the doctors when I could take Skylar home, and they said that she needed to be transferred to the Children's Hospital in Los Angeles first to make sure that they had removed all the fragments of the tumor. I'd heard of the hospital because it was run by the T.J. Martell Foundation, which helps children with leukemia, cancer, and AIDS. Since Motley Crue had done a lot of charity work for the T.J. Martell Foundation over the years, like playing against Fleetwood Mac in their first Rock and Jock softball game benefit, we won. I called Tony Martell in tears, and he made sure Skylar received the best care possible. I rode to the Children's Hospital in an ambulance with Skylar, and the moment we arrived, they ran a CAT scan on her. The thought of her being blitzed with radiation at such a young age sickened me, but I had no choice. Heidi had returned from Florida, so she waited with Charisse and me for the results. We sat there, awkward, uncomfortable, and chewing our fingernails to the skin. When the doctor returned, whatever jealousy and ill will remained among the three of us was banished forever by the news. There were tumors, the doctor said, on both of Skylar's kidneys. They would have to operate again to remove them. When we told Skylar, she buried her face in Charisse's chest and asked again when she could go home. Soon, we told her, very soon. Music studios, strip clubs, concert halls, and any semblance of my past life disappeared as the hospital became the center of my existence. Even the divorce that Charisse and I had been wrestling over for 2 years was put on hold. Every day, Charisse, myself, our parents, or Heidi sat with Skylar in her room, praying that we could take her home soon. We kept saying, just one more operation, just one more treatment, just one more day, and it would all be over. But every day, the news got worse and worse. When the doctors brought Skylar into the operating room to remove the tumors on her kidneys, they pulled back the flaps of her skin and were horrified by what they saw. The tumors were so large that simply removing them would have been fatal. They sewed her up yet again and told us she would have to undergo more radiation treatment. This way, they said, the tumors would shrink to a size at which they could be safely removed. Gradually, I began drinking again to cope with the pain. I would stay at the Children's Hospital as long as they'd let me. Then I'd drive straight to Moonshadows in Malibu and get liquored up with the regulars until I couldn't remember my own name. The next morning I'd wake up, drive to the hospital, stay all day or maybe even sleep over, and then get blitzed at Moonshadows. I knew it was wrong to be drinking at this time, but it was the only way I could keep from going completely crazy. My entire being was reduced to just three emotions: anxiety, depression, and anger. I was angry all the time. When some guy in a blue BMW cut me off on the Pacific Coast Highway, I slammed on the brakes and yelled, "Fuck you!" The guy stepped out of his car, I stepped out of mine. Heidi, who was in the passenger seat, yelled in horror, "What's wrong with you?" I stepped back into my car, spat on the windshield in anger, and was preparing to peel out when the guy threw himself over my hood and refused to move. "That's fucking it," I yelled at Heidi. I stormed out of the car, slammed the door so hard the mirror fell off, pulled him off the hood by his shirt collar, and punched him in the face in front of a crowd of gawkers. I punched him so hard that my knuckles split open to the bone. The guy dropped to the ground with blood streaming out of his face as if it had been split with an axe. Passersby had to call an ambulance to scrape him off the ground. I left before the cops arrived and gunned it to the hospital. I wasn't going to waste any more time in this piece of shit. As soon as I walked in, the doctors looked at the anger still seething on my face and then down at the blood coagulating on my hand and didn't have to ask what had happened. They brought me into the x-ray room and informed me that I'd broken my hand. They bandaged it and said there would be no charge. They knew what I was going through because they had seen it so many times before, though perhaps not to this exact degree of self-destructiveness. More and more, I fell asleep at Skylar's bedside, crying and confused, frustrated that this cancer beyond my control was growing and consuming my daughter, my life, and our future together. Every time I returned to the hospital, Skylar was in more pain and confusion. We would watch Married with Children in the hospital. Just a month ago, she used to drop whatever she was doing and dance around the house to the theme song, Frank Sinatra's Love and Marriage. But now she just stared listlessly at the television, knocked out on morphine. If we were lucky, a smile would crack open across her face and send our hearts racing with happiness. With the tumor on Skylar's right kidney starting to press against her lungs, it was a losing battle trying to preserve that smile. I brought Skylar her favorite toys and the clothes she liked to dance in. We watched Disney videos and sang children's songs together. Since I was now signed to Warner Brothers Records, I used my connections to bring entertainers in Bugs Bunny and Sylvester costumes to the hospital with big gift baskets for Skylar and the other children in the ward. On Easter, Heidi and I went to Save-On and bought bags full of candy and Easter egg painting kits. Then I did something I never would have done for Motley Crue, no matter how much they pleaded. I stripped out of my clothes and put on a giant fuzzy Easter bunny outfit. Skylar didn't even recognize me until I started talking. Then she burst out laughing. I cried, and as the tears mingled with sweat under the outfit, I turned around and said, "Charisse, hand me those eggs." "What did you just call me?" came the curt, sharp, and angry voice of Heidi. Charisse wasn't even in the hospital, and if there's anything a girlfriend doesn't forgive, it's calling her by an ex's name, even if it occurs at the sickbed of a child. For the next few minutes, Easter turned into Halloween as we put on a very different kind of show for the kids. For a relatively young girl in a new relationship, Heidi was under a lot of pressure she had never bargained for between the fact that I was still technically married and that all our dates were taking place in the presence of nurses and Charisse instead of waiters and friends. At first, everyone just saw her as a blonde bimbo. But after months of Heidi hiring entertainers such as a Snow White impersonator, sitting at Skylar's bedside, holding her hand every day, and being very careful not to compete or interfere with Charisse, the doctors and Charisse's family eventually accepted her, though never quite enough to treat her like part of the family. "Daddy?" Skylar asked when she woke up one morning. "I'm never going home, am I?" "Of course you're going home," I said. And I wasn't lying. The doctors had told me that we could take Skylar home and simply bring her in for chemotherapy. After a month straight in a hospital cot, Skylar finally returned to her own bedroom. Unfortunately, she didn't get to enjoy it for long. Every night she would sleep less and cry more, saying that her stomach hurt. When she went to the bathroom, she'd scream with a pain that sounded more wrenching than anything I'd experienced in a life 8 times as long as hers. We brought Skylar back to the hospital after only 4 nights at home. The doctor said that scar tissue from her last surgery had formed on her intestines, twisting them and obstructing her bowels. When Charisse told our daughter that she was going to have to endure another operation, Skylar said in the weakest, saddest, most innocent voice I'd ever heard, "Mommy, I don't want to die." She knew that what was happening to her was not normal, that all the smiles and jokes coming from Charisse and me were forced, that the relatives and friends who visited never used to cry when they saw her. "The nice doctors are going to help you go to sleep for a little bit while they do another operation," Charisse said, dabbing the sweat off Skylar's forehead. "And when you wake up, Mommy and Daddy will be right here waiting for you. We love you, honey, and everything is going to be okay. We'll all be home again soon." I needed to believe that what Charisse was saying was true as badly as Skylar did. After the operation, Skylar looked even worse than before. I noticed for the first time how all the life had drained out of her face, how forced and short her breathing had become, how every ounce of baby fat had been replaced by bones pressing against skin. "Daddy," she begged, "please don't let them cut me again." I didn't know what to say. The doctors had already told me that her right kidney would have to be removed. 3 days later, she was in the operating room again. And when the doctors wheeled her back, it wasn't like the TV shows. They never said, "Congratulations, the operation was a success." They said, "I'm sorry, Vince, but something unexpected happened. The cancer has spread to her liver, intestines, and dorsal muscles. Did you remove the kidney? No. We couldn't even remove the tumor. It isn't responding well to chemo. It is bonded so tightly to her kidney that to remove it would cause fatal blood loss. That, however, does not mean that there is no hope. There are other options available to us, and, God willing, one of them will get rid of this thing for good. But this thing kept growing, consuming the girl I loved too much too late. On June 3rd, I received a call from the oncologist in charge of Skylar's doctors. When you're at the hospital every day, the last thing you want to do is pick up the phone at home and hear a doctor's voice, because it can only mean one thing. Skylar had stopped breathing, the oncologist told me. The doctors had just placed her on a respirator and injected her with a medication that, in effect, paralyzed her so that she wouldn't expend excess energy. She couldn't laugh, she couldn't move, she couldn't speak. In 4 months, she had gone from a happy little 4-year-old to a sad, wired-up mannequin. She never even had a chance to live, and now she was in a worse condition than most people in nursing homes. For all practical purposes, she was death with a heartbeat, though I tried to convince myself that it was just a temporary sleep. She was a strong girl, though, and her body continued to fight the cancer. Her signs stabilized, her heart rate increased, and every now and then her lungs would pump a little air on their own. After a month and a half of this limbo state, the doctors decided that they had no choice. It was better to attempt to remove the tumor than just leave her hovering in and out of life. The operation was extremely dangerous, but if Skylar made it through, they said it was very likely that she would recover. Charisse's family, my family, Charisse, and my son Neil joined Heidi and me in the hospital, and we all sat nervously together, taking turns running out for food while waiting for a word from the doctors operating on her. We fidgeted the whole time, unable to utter a sentence without bursting into tears. I thought about how cancer ran in my mother's side of the family and wondered if this was my fault. Or maybe I shouldn't have let the doctors treat Skylar with chemotherapy in the first place. I should have told them to remove the kidney. I should have brought Skylar to the hospital when she complained of a stomach ache half a year ago. Various thoughts ran through my mind, all containing those poisonous and impotent two words, should have. Finally, after 8 hours of anxiety, the doctors came out to say that Skylar was back in her room. They had successfully removed the tumor. It weighed 6.5 pounds. That's how much Skylar had weighed when she was born. I couldn't even conceive of something that immense growing inside her. I wanted to see what was killing my daughter, so I asked the doctors if they had kept the tumor. They brought me down to the pathology lab, showed it to me, and my stomach turned. I'd never seen anything like it before. It was the face of evil. It lay spread out in a metal pan, a nacreous mess of shit. It looked like a gelatinous football that had been rolled through the depths of hell, collecting vomit, bile, and every other dropping of the dam that lay in its path. It was, in every conceivable way, the exact opposite of the daughter Charisse and I had raised. In the process of removing the cancer, the doctors also had to take out Skylar's right kidney, half her liver, some of her diaphragm, and a muscle in her back. How many more organs could a girl lose and still be alive? But she was breathing and the cancer was gone. Every day she recovered a little more until she could speak and smile. Every gesture she made, a blink, a yawn, the word daddy, felt like a gift. I thought that everything would be okay now, that the nightmare was over, that Skylar could be a child again. I stopped drinking at Moonshadows and began cleaning up the house and my life for Skylar's return. 6 days after the operation, I was walking into the hospital with a giant stuffed panda when I was greeted by the doctors. They had that look. The look that says everything and nothing at all. The look of bad news that must inevitably and regrettably be delivered. I braced myself and knew before a word was spoken that I'd be back at Moonshadows that night. "Vince," the oncologist said, "it seems like an infection may be developing around Skylar's left kidney." That's all she's got left. What does this mean? I'm afraid it means we're going to have to operate again and clean up around the kidney. Jesus, you've already operated on my baby 5 times. How much more can she take? It turned out that she couldn't take much more. After the operation, she went into a fast decline. Her lungs, her left kidney, and her liver all began a mutiny, refusing to function properly. Mercifully, she soon slipped into a coma. Her little body just couldn't take any more. It had been cut open and sewn back up so many times. It had been pumped so full of drugs. It had been shot through with more radiation than anyone should be exposed to. It had endured the slicing, dicing, rearranging, scraping, and removal of so many of its contents that, like a brake that had been pressed over and over, the parts had worn away and no longer knew how to work together. When your body starts to fall apart, there's no one who can fix the machine. They can only keep it running for a little while longer. And sometimes I wonder whether I did the right thing by keeping Skylar running for so long. Keeping her in such pain for 5 months. 1/10 of her entire life. I began to drink so heavily that I wouldn't last more than an hour at Moonshadows without passing out or vomiting all over Kelsey Grammer. I cut the most pathetic figure. A father who just couldn't deal with the pain of knowing that soon he would have to undergo the worst tragedy that a parent can bear. Having to bury his own daughter. I'd given Skylar everything I had to give, even my own blood for transfusions. I would have been willing to lay down my own life if it would have helped. I'd never thought anything like that before. Not about my wife, not about my parents, not about anybody. Perhaps that was why I was trying to kill myself with the drink, so that somehow I could martyr myself and exchange my suffering for hers. Every morning I would sit at her bedside hungover and read her stories and tell her jokes and pretend to be brave, like everything could still possibly be okay. It shouldn't have come as a surprise when the oncologist told me to start bringing in her relatives and friends to say their goodbyes. But that was the first time I'd heard the doctor say that there was no hope. Before, there was always a small chance, or a good chance, or a tiny chance, or a fair chance, but never no chance. Perhaps I had reassured Skylar so many times that she would return home one day, and we'd build sandcastles on the beach again that I began to believe it myself. I walked into Skylar's room with Heidi afterward and saw drops of blood on her lip. Heidi was outraged that the nurses would just leave her lying there in that condition. She took a tissue out of her purse and bent down to wipe it. But the blood just stayed there on Skylar's lip. It had coagulated. Heidi kept wiping it and crying, "You fix it, you fix it." We both broke down on the spot. We stayed with Skylar until late at night when we left to get some food at Moonshadows. In the meantime, Charisse and her parents arrived to sit with Skylar. As soon as we settled down at a table, the bartender said I had a phone call. "Vince, get to the hospital now," came Charisse's trembling voice on the other end. Her vital signs are dropping fast. I didn't panic, I didn't cry, I just hurried. But I was too late. By the time I arrived at the hospital, Skylar had passed away. And I never had a chance to say goodbye and tell her one more time how much I loved her. Charisse said that Skylar had passed away peacefully. When her heartbeat started slowing, her eyes had opened with a momentary flash of fear and met her mother's in search of an answer or explanation. "Don't be scared, sweetie," Charisse had reassured her, squeezing her hand. "Go to sleep now. It's all right." And so Skylar slept. In the meantime, I sat in traffic on the Pacific Coast Highway, and for an instant, my heart jumped in my chest. But I was in such a hurry to be by Skylar's bedside that I ignored it and didn't think about it. But afterward, I realized that when the woman that I loved most in this world left, my heart knew it, and for a moment, wanted to catch up with her and join her. I left the hospital, drove straight to Moonshadows, borrowed a couple of painkillers from the Joe Isuzu actor David Leisure, and drank. Without the hospital, the bar became the entire focus of my existence. I put myself in a fog the night Skylar died, and with booze and pills, kept myself there so that I wouldn't have to think about it. I was her father, and I was supposed to protect her. I had done everything in my power for Skylar, everything, and the truth was that I was powerless. She was gone, I was here, and there was no changing that. The only thing that could be changed was for me not to be here, but I didn't have the balls to kill myself. I hoped that the booze and the pills would do the trick. I would take 20 10-milligram doses of Valium a day and drink hundreds of dollars in beer and whiskey. I didn't fucking care what happened to me. Sometimes I would imagine getting run down by a car, or decapitated by a madman, or just throwing myself through a window. I wanted to be with her so badly. Heidi and a diamond merchant I had met through Tommy and Heather, Bob Prokop, who was staying at my house after his was destroyed in an earthquake, arranged the funeral and took care of me like an invalid. I was incapable of showering, changing clothes, or doing anything for myself. I'd never had a relative that was close to me die before. I'd never even been to a funeral before. Now here I was, burying my own daughter. This wasn't how things were supposed to work. Skylar's grandparents had arranged a closed casket service for her, but someone screwed up and the casket was open. Inside was someone who didn't even look like my daughter. Her eyes were so swollen that I could see the root of her eyelash. I didn't want that to be my last image of her, so throughout the service, I stared at my feet. I couldn't bring myself to look at her pink casket. It was so little. She was so little. After the service, I was basically kidnapped, put in a limousine, and the next thing I knew I was in a rehab clinic called Anacapa in Oxnard. Heidi had called in our one-man personal crisis hotline, Bob Timmons. I escaped that day, returned home to Malibu, swallowed a cocktail of pills from the medicine cabinet, and passed out. When I awoke, I was in another bed. I had somehow left home and checked into the Universal City Sheraton Hotel where I continued to anesthetize myself. But whatever I did was never enough. Every night I woke up screaming from terrible nightmares. I'd imagine demons and devils dancing on Skylar's grave. Skylar's headstone had been ordered, but it hadn't been made yet. So I kept having the worst visions about it not being there and there being nothing to mark her grave. In other nightmares, I'd see her tumor growing to the size of a human being and attacking me, enveloping me in its cancer. And as the tumor smothered me, it would give off a strong odor. Not the smell of putrefaction or death, but the sweet, warm smell of Skylar. I'd taken the blanket she died in from the hospital, and every night I slept under it because the smell made me think of her as still living in this world. I spent at least a week in that nightmare state, unsure when I was conscious and when I wasn't, until Heidi and Bob Timmons finally talked me into checking into the Betty Ford Center. But before I went, I told them I was playing golf first. I somehow thought that would rehabilitate me. I flew to Palm Desert a couple hundred miles away and booked a room at the Marriott. For a week, I drank alone, played golf alone, passed out alone. Then I locked my clubs and my clothes in my room and took a taxi to the Betty Ford Center. After 3 days of rehab, I was ready to really lose my mind. I couldn't deal with the therapist, the discipline, the guilt they kept heaping on me. I walked into the front office and said, "I'm out of here." They wanted their full $15,000 fee. I wrote a check and called a cab to the Marriott. Fuck them. I drank, golfed, and passed out for what was probably another month. I was lost to the world. I put myself in limbo. It looked like heaven, and I felt like hell. One day I shot a 76 and became so excited that I scared myself. I wasn't supposed to be this happy. Skylar was gone. What was I doing? I was running. I was hiding. I was playing golf at a resort. I called Heidi and Bob Timmons again, and this time they flew me to L.A. to check back into Anacapa in Oxnard. The treatment, they said, wasn't so much for alcohol or pills or golf as it was for grief. I needed to find a way to work through my emotions, to treat them with something besides a bottle and a five iron. I wrote Skylar a note, and then I set it on fire and burned it, watching the smoke ascend into the sky. That, for me, was the beginning of accepting a past I could not change. I began to think about Skylar's life in a different light, and to thank God for the 4 years that he gave her and allowed me to spend with her. I pledged to commit a greater percentage of my remaining life to charity work, to help other children and parents who were suffering, and to make sure that Skylar's death had not been in vain. When I called my parents and Heidi, they could tell simply by hearing my voice, which shook and sobbed less, that I'd come out the other end, that I could visit her grave now and decorate it with confetti and flowers on her birthday, and that I could finally smile when I remembered the funny things she used to do. I hadn't thought about Motley Crue in so long, and clearly they hadn't thought about me. Sure, we were at war, but as far as I was concerned, all our little hissy fits seemed so stupid and petty after what I'd been through. Not once, however, did those guys, who'd been closer to me than my own sister, ever call. Maybe they just didn't know how to call or what to say. They would have to say something soon, because the week I was being released from rehab also happened to be the week we were supposed to meet for the first time in 4.5 years, in court. In all the drama of the past half year, I had forgotten that I had sued them. While I was in rehab, Charisse and I finalized our divorce, and Heidi, who was closer to me than we ever expected to get after all this, moved into my place in Malibu. It was hard for Charisse and me to talk afterward. Skylar's illness had created a strong bond between us, but once she passed away, that bond snapped completely. Recently, however, the bond renewed itself. I kept asking the doctors how Skylar had gotten cancer, and they'd tell me that certain foods and chemicals and exposure to the sun and this and that all can cause cancer. But she's 4, I tell them. She's 4. What the fuck does a 4-year-old do to get cancer like that? She doesn't eat a lot of sugar. She uses sunscreen. She's a normal, average kid. I never found an answer. I just accepted the situation. But one day I was watching a news program about government rocket testing and chemical dumping in an area just north of Malibu called Simi Valley. That was where Charisse and I had lived. One of the reasons we had bought a house there was because it was on top of a hill, and the area surrounding it, the real estate agent told me, was government-owned. So it would never be developed, which was great because I didn't want to look down on some ugly construction zone or plot of prefab houses. We like seeing a beautiful field and valley and wide open space outside every morning.